Slow Burn Media, an evergreen podcast, presents Who Killed? A podcast that provides a voice for the voiceless. Hello and welcome to episode 158 or so of Who Killed? I am your host, Bill Huffman, and this is a Slow Burn Media and evergreen podcast production. On this week's episode, we are going to actually take a look back at the past and one of my interviews with the guys who run Crawlspace, and that's Tim and Lance, and they've done a lot on Maura Murray, and that is a case that I had mentioned I'd like to see solved in 2022, and due to some health issues and some minor hiccups, I needed to pull out an old episode, and I hope you guys enjoy it. They are some characters, and if you haven't listened to their podcast, check it out. It's Crawlspace. They also run Crawlspace Media. And again, they're really good people, and I'm sure they'll be at CrimeCon. So look forward to seeing them there. And I hope you guys enjoy this episode with Tim and Lance. This was from My Passion Case, and we discuss the case of Maura Murray. Enjoy. Thanks a lot for joining me, guys. We got Tim and Lance here from Missing Maura Murray. And if you're a true crime fanatic or true crime listener, you are familiar with this case. And if you are familiar with this case, you're also familiar with Tim and Lance. So I have got them here to talk to you guys. And if you would like to explain or introduce yourselves and a little bit about your background and, you know, what kind of things led you to, one, hosting a podcast, and two, the case?
Well, mostly the money,
yes,
the fame, and the women, and
the power.
I don't know, free donuts I get sometimes, yeah. Because everyone in town knows who I am and what I do.
The cult status. We're basically a cult now.
Could technically be considered a cult leader if we wanted to go that path. Obviously we don't.
Well,
yet.
We don't want to commit ourselves one way or the other.
Well, it's going to lead to commitment.
I mean,
sorry.
Potato, potato.
Yeah.
Well, it's like the, yeah, it's like that meme, you know? It's like, you've got to, I'm not a cult leader, but what do you call your what do you call these people? My followers.
Yeah. No, we're definitely not cult leaders. But it would be interesting if some podcaster ever tried to start a cult that way. I'm sure that's probably happened.
I'm pretty sure people have tried. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you tried, Bill, right? Thanks for having us on, by the way. It's really cozy in here with you.
Well, I appreciate again the time. I mean, to get you guys one cornered for even whatever amount of time I get you for the day is pretty shocking. I know you guys do, and you're everywhere. You know, with your business and Crime Fest and all that shit that's going on. So
it's a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. I can only imagine what your daily schedule's like. So
micro naps. Yeah. You ever heard of the God helmet?
I think of that Seinfeld episode where Kramer slept every 15 minutes, but I don't think of But yeah, you know. So anyway, Maura Murray.
Yeah. So the real answer is we sort of stumbled into this case and business of podcasting, sort of different ways. I had done like some fantasy football podcast and a which I'm still actually kind of doing. And a comedy podcast. So I had a little experience doing that. And Lance, unbeknownst to me, on the other side of the country here in Boston, Lance was looking into the Maura Murray case online and had come across James Renner's blog and was actually even the very first view on YouTube of Alden House Olsen's happy anniversary video. And I think that is where Lance's 15 minutes of fame began and ended, because he'll never get past that, I think. Is that right, Lance?
That's actually completely accurate. It was 100% accurate. The Alden House Olsen video has become sort of iconic in the Maura Murray case. It's the video where he is rocking back and forth, and he's looking at his computer screen, and he's just cackling and cackling and cackling. And then at the end, he stops laughing abruptly and winks at the camera, and the words come up, and it says happy anniversary. And it was right around the anniversary of Maura's disappearance. That was the second video that he had uploaded. The first one was a ski ticket. It was a cross-country ski pass to Bretton Woods, and that's right around the area where Maura went missing, and it was dated a few days after her disappearance. The video was titled Maura Murray. So he had started this buzz before that happy anniversary video, and James Renner had put on his blog, "What the hell is this?" And he had a link to the ski ticket video. And I was doing some editing work, and I was refreshing the YouTube channel, and I saw his video numbers go from 1 to 2. So yeah, I was the first one to view that. I have been collecting all of the royalties and the accolades, and I've been given several keys to cities since then. Yeah. And not to mention a Netflix special exclusively dedicated to that day that I discovered the video. It's a 20-part series that's told over the course of 7 years. And it's won several Emmys and Oscars and a Grammy.
So you're covered.
Yeah. So at that point, Lance was wanting to do a documentary on the case, and this was back in 2013, probably, or 2012, I guess. That happened. And then Lance sort of slowly became friendly with James Renner, and
I'd say rapidly.
I guess so.
I'm just kidding.
and so you decided to do a documentary, and you asked me to do it with you. And so the first thing we did to do that documentary was jump in a van with James Renner and drive from Boston to the crash site, and then on to Sherbrooke, Quebec, and other places in Quebec, Canada, because that's where Renner thought Maura Murray might be. And so it was like a literal hunt at first, like looking for a person. Now, so many years past that, it seems a little silly that we were like, looking like in certain areas and things like that. But at the time, it was certainly fascinating and interesting, and we knew we were at least filming something out of it. So after we filmed that was December of 2013, Lance filmed a little bit more with some other people up at the crash site that I think we're planning to release sometime soon. And then about a year went by, and there wasn't much going on. I think ultimately it was hard to meet a lot of armchair detectives or citizen detectives through like email, I guess, by saying, "Hey, I'm doing a documentary on people like you, you know, like what's your theory?" And because I think a lot of people, armchair sleuths, are private, and they'll hop on the phone with you, but to be on a documentary, it's a little bit much for some of those people. So
yeah, I think it's really permanent for them, you know. Yeah. When they're online and they're operating under a certain moniker, and they can behave as liberally as they want, that's one thing. They can delete that moniker, they can delete comments, it can feel like they've separated themselves from it. But when it's not in their control anymore, I think that changes the game for them. So started off pretty good. We had James, and we had a couple that had no problem going up to the crash site and being interviewed, and another gentleman that had no problem with it. But after that, it came to a pretty grinding halt.
Yeah. So that was sort of why we decided to do the podcast, was to get more interviews and to get ourselves kind of out there as this, documentary crew that was trying to produce this documentary. And the podcast was sort of not our attempt to be accurate about the case, because I guess there was really no way to be completely accurate, not knowing really much of the facts, and really not much of them really being out there, other than kind of like rumor and what James has done and what some other people have put out there. But it's not like there is much that's public, or was at that point. So we sort of did the podcast to kind of get people talking, and it worked and took on a life of its own. And so that kind of actually became more of the priority than the documentary, because it was just, we could see the numbers. We saw people were listening, and we're like, well, we can do this documentary. And we didn't stop filming too, I should say. So we were kind of documenting ourselves behind the scenes throughout all that. And then we were approached by the Texas Crew production company, who eventually made the TV show that turned into the Disappearance of Maura Murray TV show that went to Oxygen. And so we were sort of like talking to them behind the scenes and keeping the podcast going, and really just trying to wait until there was like a budget to investigate, because we didn't really have a budget, you know?
And it was really a lot like a train that you just got on and it was going. And there was a responsibility that came along with it. And it became more than, you know, really interesting group of people that are passionate about a disappearance. So for better or worse, it was a train that we had to see through to the end, or we are seeing through until a certain conclusion, I guess.
Yeah. When is it over? Gosh.
Yeah, seriously.
Hopefully it ends with the case being solved sometime soon. And I mean, ultimately the reason we got involved was because the people who were interested in it, but so many people wouldn't be interested in this case if it wasn't completely fascinating. And it seems like Maura Murray vanished into thin air on the side of the road on a Monday night in North Haverhill, New Hampshire.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is a perfect example or a perfect opportunity for you to just sort of give the nuts and bolts about, like, the, you know, the five W's.
Yeah. So Maura was a college student. She was in nursing school at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, which is in sort of western Massachusetts. And she had, she was 21 at the time. So she had actually previously attended West Point. So her grades were so amazing, and she was such an athlete in track in particular, that she was accepted into West Point, which is a pretty big deal. And so I think she did okay there for a while, but ultimately sort of seems to have sort of caused her own
dismissal.
I think
we don't have anything definitive on why, like, what was going on in her head when she did this thing. She stole a small amount of makeup from a from like the school store, and that was a violation of their code of ethics. And she ended up leaving West Point, and she went into the UMass Amherst nursing program, which is about as it's like the next step down. So you have West Point, and then you have the nursing program at UMass Amherst, and that is a very, very rigorous program. So it's not like she was afraid of the hard work.
So then she was in school and had some friends, and a couple of nights before she disappeared, she actually crashed her father's car, going from school to drop the car off at his hotel room down the road. And so it's sort of a weird accident, because it's like a T intersection. She's coming down the end of the T where you have to, you know, make a turn. And she didn't. She crashed into a guardrail, and there was some snow on the ground. I believe it was snowing at the time, so I think that's why she crashed. But she totaled her dad's car. And then 2 days later, she didn't tell anybody other than her professors and her boss at one of her jobs. She said that there was a death in the family, and she was going to be away for a little while. Like, I think she said, did she specify, Lance, like a week or two or something?
I want to say that it was at least a week that she was going. She had to leave, and it was at least a week. But I don't even know if that's anything more than hearsay. I think whoever has that specific email, you know, that's probably with the police or something.
But. Yeah, I think it was shown in the Oxygen show.
Was it? Was it?
I think so. I thought so.
It could have been, and I could have written that off as like a recreation or something. But I want to say it was like 4 days or a week. Either way, it was an extended period of time during.
Yeah, I'm not sure if she specified. Yeah,
during that time frame.
Right. So, but that was not true that there was any death in the family. So, but it sounds like she just wanted to get away. But the problem is she didn't tell anybody. So nobody, to our knowledge, still after looking into the case as long as we have, has said that they know where Maura was going. We know that she ended up about 3 hours north of Amherst, where she was living at the time at UMass, and she was sort of about 10 minutes off the highway, off Highway 91, and she was on like a mountain pass road called Route 112, and it's very windy. And her car was found on the side of the road after, we think, hitting a snowbank. And there was some alcohol found in the car. But the car was locked, and her keys, backpack, wallet, phone was taken with her. And there was no sign of foul play at the car.
To give you a little bit of a sense of the geography up there, Tim said she was about 10 minutes off the highway, which is 91. That road, Route 112, is a pretty common bypass in between Route 93. If you were coming from Boston, you'd go up Route 93. And if you were coming from Western Mass, you'd go up Route 91. So it's east and west. And that's a pretty common pass through to cut through the mountains. It is windy. It does have a lot of hairpin turns on it. And she happened to spin out of control at the one hairpin turn that, I mean, had probably the most residential population, probably like, I'd say like 2 or 3 miles on either side. There's five homes right there. She was seen by a number of people. And as far as where she was going, it does sound strange talking about it. Like, oh, well, who would do that? But you got to put yourself back in 2004. There's no social media going on. A lot of people, since we started doing this show, have told us, including young women, have said, yeah, if I hike, if I do things that are outdoorsy and I just need to get away for a couple of days, I'll just go. And a lot of people just, you know, unfortunately don't say where they're going because they might not have a destination. And more recently, I've started to think that she didn't have a destination. She had an idea in her mind because she was on that pass, that Route 112. So she had an idea where she was going, but I don't think she really knew where she was going to go until she arrived.
Yeah, that's definitely an interesting aspect of the theory, or, you know, of the case, because what did drive her other than herself 3 hours away and to pick up alcohol in the process?
Yeah, I don't know what did drive her. I think she wanted to get away. I mean, that's the only thing that I can say that I know. Yeah. I think, you know.
Yeah, she had just like crashed up her dad's car. She was working on the insurance problems with not problems, but she was working on the insurance collection for that, filing the papers and everything. I mean, the school program, the people have said that she's had trouble with her boyfriend at the time. I just think there was a lot of stuff going on, and she might have just had an opportunity to personally say, I just need to take a break. I need to go and, you know, clear my head for a couple of days. I don't really think it's that weird that she picked up alcohol along the way either.
No, I don't think that in particular is, you know, odd, but the day that she was leaving, wasn't that a Monday that she,
yeah.
So she said, you know, she sent that email to her professor, said, I'm going to be gone for 2 weeks or a week or whatever she said, due to a death in the family. You know, it's like, what drove her to make, you know, I mean, if you're going to miss 2 weeks of school, that's a significant amount of time.
I don't think it was 2 weeks. I think, I don't know if there was like a determined period of time. I think, okay. I think it might've been like, she was probably indicating that she would be back like next week, you know?
Gotcha.
Leaving on Monday, she was probably thinking she'd go up a couple days, see what happens. And for some reason, 4 days is in my head, but I know that's not specifically right. I think I might have just told myself that based on just what, you know, what we know so far.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, I don't remember anything specific, but yeah,
It is interesting to show to the, it goes to show how just semantics might influence other people's perception of this, because just simply, you know, saying like a week and then that turns into 2 weeks and now that goes out there and people think like, what was she doing for 2 weeks? It's such a specific period of time, mm-hmm. you know, just not having that information is really what's happened with this case and what we try to clear up pretty much on a daily basis, because it's at no fault to anybody because it's just there, you know, there's a bunch of information out there and no one really knows what the most accurate piece of information is.
But she did disappear there. So the car spun out, she hit the snowbank, and this is a really wild kind of turn too. Sort of a 90-degree angle, and she spun out, hit a snowbank. The closest neighbor called 911 and said there was a flurry of activity at the trunk. You may have heard that there was a rag found in the tailpipe. We think when Miss Westman said that there was flurry of activity by the trunk, that was Maura going into the trunk and taking that rag out and then putting it in the tailpipe herself. We think that was an attempt at trying to get her car out of the little ditch that it was in. And if you're familiar with the case, you'll know what the rag in the tailpipe is. And that's sort of the only answer that, that I can accept at this point. We've completely moved past it, I think. And I don't accept any other theories on it at this point. I have to be honest on that one.
Well, I mean, Tim, you've often said that you think that it was some nefarious individual that was at a gas station and saw her and stuck the rag in the tailpipe so that he could follow her until she spun out on the road.
No, that's incorrect. Although I believe
there was a movie in the 90s called Breakdown with Kurt Russell and something similar to that.
Great movie.
That is a good movie. I actually watched that recently.
Nerve wracking as all hell. Cause
yeah, it is.
Very I used to go to school at the University of Utah, and driving from Cleveland to Utah was like, you talk about driving through nothing.
Yikes. So,
yeah. I mean, like, it was like Joyride, that movie Joyride.
Oh yeah, that was a good one.
In Wyoming, and then it just there's nothing. I mean, you could hit the scan on the radio and just plays all the way through, and I'm assuming that that's what the, you know, similar conditions are where she disappeared. I mean, because what is it up there? Mountains and water and
yeah, it's beautiful. Beautiful mountains, but she was kind of in the foothills of the White Mountains, I will say. She was sort of at like a mountain pass road, and it's the road that is a very windy road. It goes along a river, and it goes up very, very high, and then it goes down back again. And it kind of connects two highways, the other highway being 93. And so you can get up to that part of the country those two ways, basically those two main ways. So I think it's pretty rural, but if you were going to dump a car, like Lance has said a lot of times, that you just wouldn't have done it there. Like there's three houses that could have seen the car, that did see the car from their window. You know, so if she was getting away, you know, she just would have driven up the road like a half a mile and had a much easier time. So I think the accident was earnest. You know, the area is pretty rural, and there are some unsavory individuals in the immediate area.
Especially at the time. Since then, it's cleaned up a little bit, but yeah, it was a pretty bad spot for her to get into that accident.
Do you mind expanding on that just a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, the more we look into it, the more information we gather, and we have read what is public, court documents and statements and just unrelated to Maura about some people who live up there. I mean, can't totally get into specifics, but I mean, there are documents that we've read about neighbors up there that, I mean, it just like turns your stomach what they're being accused and convicted of.
Yeah. And I think you know, before, I'm sorry to jump in there. You know, it's like, I know Renner as well. He's actually local to me. So, I've known him for about a decade, and like, I know that when he was investigating the Mihaljevic case, he was just shocked on just how many people fall into that category of unsavory or just straight up creepy.
Yeah, I think that's true probably with every case. And you know, it just so happened we came across some of these people because not all of them are guilty, obviously. Maybe one or two of them are, but it's probably not even likely. You know, we only came across them because Maura crashed there, you know. Like, what if she crashed somewhere else? Would we have been, we probably would have had a different, the same list with different names. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. It's everywhere. It's everywhere. We've looked into Breonna Maitland's disappearance as well, and we've found the same type of people up in that area, but we've also found really good people in both areas. There's very good people. You have the transplants that go there and they're retired and they're, you know, amazing people. You have people who have been there for 40 years and they're rooted in and they don't want to be bothered by outsiders coming in and asking questions about something that they have no control over. So there's a few different types of people there and, you know, everywhere.
So what happened after Maura had crashed her car? And at that point, like, I mean, she's basically out in the middle of the boonies. And I mean, now she, I mean, there, of course, like you mentioned, a couple houses, but what happens next? What's the next big thing that
From DNA testing to the Dixie Mafia, Crime Capsule brings you new stories of true crime in American history. I'm your host, Benjamin Morris. Join us for exclusive interviews with authors from Arcadia Publishing, writing the hottest books on the most chilling stories of our country's past. You can find us wherever you get your favorite podcasts or on evergreenpodcasts.com. Crime Capsule, history so interesting, it's criminal.
Happens. Let's hear from this week's sponsor. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp Online Therapy. We all know relationships take work, especially the most important one you have in your life, your relationship with yourself. A lot of us will drop anything to go help someone we care about. We'll go out of our way to treat other people well. But think about it. How often do we give ourselves the same treatment? I go out of my way to take time each day to focus on myself. It's an essential part of my routine. This month, BetterHelp Online Therapy wants to remind you that you matter just as much as everyone else does. And therapy is a great way to make sure you show up for yourself. Listeners of this show know I'm a huge proponent of mental health, and I have personally been in therapy since I was a kid. So, BetterHelp is online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can be matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. Give it a try and see why over 2 million people have used BetterHelp online therapy. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and Who Killed listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/who. That's BETTERHELP.com/who. All right, we are back.
Well, honestly, that's basically it, except that there was a bus driver that drove past or drove by and stopped and talked to Maura and was the last person that we know talked to Maura. And he asked her if she needed help. She said, no, I'm going to call AAA. And she showed him her phone. And there is sort of different accounts on whether she got out of the car or not. In that exchange. So I'm not really sure. Butch Atwood, the bus driver, is no longer alive. So we can't get him to answer at this point, but that's what we know. But we also know that Butch went to his house, which was like a couple hundred yards down the road, and he called 911 himself as well as the neighbor who was closest. And Maura, when she said that she was calling AAA, she might have been trying to call AAA, but she wasn't calling AAA because there is no service there. And that's true even today in 2019. So yes, she was stuck there without the ability to get her car out of there. She needed to rely on someone, and she turned Butch down. Yeah.
And then in the meantime, you know, Butch goes into his house. Him and his common-law wife have a conversation about it. The neighbor across the street, Faith Westman, is looking at the car, and she's describing the car, its position and everything to the dispatcher from the police station. And at some point, the best we can tell is that she walked away from the car and walked up the street towards Bradley Hill Road, towards where Butch Atwood lives and where he parked his bus. And that's where the scent dogs lost her scent. And that's the only indication of a direction in which she walked or was picked up, I guess, because they abruptly lost her scent right around the corner, Bradley Hill Road. And Butch Atwood had gone back out to his van. I'm sorry, had gone back out to his bus, was sitting in his bus doing his paperwork, which I guess he normally does in his bus. It's probably like a bus driver log or something. And he said he saw some cars going by, but he didn't see any people. And then he was enlisted by the arriving officer, Cecil Smith, to help in the search. So he went off towards, in the opposite direction, I believe initially in the opposite direction, he took a loop around, they said, which is around French Pond Road. You can do this loop around, and he didn't see anybody. So somewhere along the lines, and I think it's not a secret that Tim and I believe that she was picked up by somebody because of the abruptness that her scent was lost by the dogs, and the fact that no one saw it. No, she didn't knock on any doors. There's no account of that. And it was there 1 minute, gone the next. And the only way you can do that, unless you can fly, is get picked up by a car.
Yeah, I would say that I think she willingly got into a car. That's the only thing I'll sort of adjust there. I don't think she was ripped into some car violently or anything like that. I think, to me, what's the most likely thing is that she got into a car willingly and was taken somewhere, and was that, I think that person probably did something to her. Now I think a lot of people will say, but Tim, Occam's razor, the most likely thing is that she wandered out into the wilderness right there. She was in the mountains, and she just hasn't been found yet. And I think that's fair. That's fair to say that. So I think those are the two most likely things. And Lance and I will disagree on if Maura hit her head on the windshield or not. I think it was the windshield crack was made by her head. And so I think she might have been suffering from a little bit of a head injury and wasn't thinking clearly. Again, as Lance said, the search dogs stopped at a certain point on the street. So I think that's indicative of her maybe getting into the passenger side of a car going the same way that she was traveling. So I think I put that at very high likelihood, but I think there's also a chance she kept walking and stumbled into the woods and possibly into the river. But I do think with the amount of searches that have happened in the years since, and even the immediate searches, I just kind of think she would have been found.
It's very telling when you look at what was left in her car and what she took with her, because what she took with her is really indicative of someone who's expecting to be reunited with her car at some point. Just a phone, backpack, wallet, ID, and then the car's lock. So phone, keys, wallet. That's what I would take if I was leaving my car briefly and I was going to come back.
Yeah, and didn't she take a backpack too? I mean, it was like if you're going to leave your stuff, I mean, you're going to take all the essentials, and she actually took all the essentials.
Yeah, we believe she took some alcohol with her too, I think. We're not 100% clear on what was taken or not.
That's where you play the game with like the authorities, because only they really know for sure what was left and what was taken. And
yeah,
there's a list of what was left in her car, but that was only after it was recovered again from Kathleen Murray, Maura's sister. And they made this list of the things that were left in her car. So there's a lot of gray area there that the public doesn't know, that law enforcement probably does know, that maybe is significant, but they don't know yet, or maybe they don't know if it's significant. So they're not going to put anything out there right now.
What was the, weather that night? Was it snowing like significantly that night, or was it snowing at all, or was it just, you know, because you would think that might play a role in the ability for the dogs to get a good scent?
It was not snowing. It was actually sort of unseasonably warm. I think it was in the 30s that night. It snowed, I think, the next day. Or no, wait, I'm sorry. It snowed. I'm going to take it back. I think it snowed the day before. And
I think you're right. I think it snowed the next day. There was like a light dusting when they...
But it was before the accident, I think, because it made the search conditions pretty optimal. Like, they would have seen her footprints.
Right.
But the weather wasn't a cause for the accident?
No. Who knows? It could have been. I mean, we don't know. Like, she could have hit some ice. Okay. When you're driving up there and you do take that route and you take that turn, you can maybe, and it's dark too, so you got to keep that in mind. She might have seen something out of the corner of her eye that she thought was like a rabbit, you know, and then she looks up and she overcorrects because she misjudged the turn, and her car goes into the snowdrift and then spins around and gets hung up. It looks like she wasn't expecting that. It looks like she wasn't expecting that corner. And to be honest, I actually went up there this weekend and was driving, and those corners just sneak up on you. We've driven that route numerous times, and every time there's always one curve that just kind of sneaks up on you. And if you're not paying attention, or if you've had a little bit to drink and it's the nighttime, you totally see how you could just spin out just based on how the geography unrolls in front of you.
Do they believe that she was drinking while she was driving? Okay.
I don't go so far as to say like drunk driving.
Right.
But there was open alcohol containers in her car and liquid found around her car.
Gotcha.
Yeah, we think the police they believe that was the case, but we don't, I guess, know for a fact.
Yeah, I just remember listening to, you know, one episode of something and hearing about, you know, alcohol on the ceiling and just, you know, assuming that it could possibly be from either an open container or just the crash itself. But it does lead you to believe that most likely she was probably drinking at that time, especially if she was as stressed out as, you know, it sounds like she was.
Yeah, she was in a very tough nursing program. I think she was probably about to break up with her boyfriend at the time, who was sort of a long-term boyfriend, but he wasn't anywhere near her. He was located in Oklahoma at the time of Maura's disappearance.
Is that Billy Roush?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Yeah, so like, so as far as like the snow and the, you know, the conditions and stuff like that, you said it was optimal for searching. Did they take her? Like, did they automatically think that she was missing, or did they? How did they apply their police procedures? I guess.
Right. Well, they did enlist the help of the bus driver Butch immediately after the accident. And the one officer, they searched a little bit around the vicinity, the immediate vicinity. And then it's in the police report that it's like, oh, she'll probably show up at the cottage hospital, which isn't far. And they just assumed, I think, that she probably got into a car and was taken to the hospital. And obviously she never showed up. So I think they placed a call to, I think it was Kathleen first. I can't remember exactly the order of events, but the search didn't take place until I think it was 2 days later. They got, you know, the family up there. Bill came from Oklahoma. As far as I know, I think UMass police did some investigating with Maura's friends at UMass. And I think they coordinated a little bit with the New Hampshire State Police. That's kind of it. I mean, you know, there's been a ton of rumors and things like that since. So it really depends what rabbit hole you want to go down. But as far as confirmed sightings, that's it.
Yeah, and there's a lot of talk about how the police might have, you know, botched the case from the start. And it's like, they see 100 abandoned vehicles with alcohol in them, and then the person goes away, sobers up, and comes back, or goes to the hospital. It's very, very common. If you actually look at the police dispatch log, they kept all their eye, as many eyes out there, as many eyes open that they had out there for her that night. And then they had to figure out, first of all, they had to figure out who she was, because the car wasn't registered in her name. And then they had to figure out how to contact her dad. And, you know, it takes time. And yeah, I mean, going back on it now, I'm 100% sure that all of the police involved would handle it differently.
So speaking of that, it's a good segue into her dad. What's your thoughts on Fred?
He is laser focused on finding his daughter. Even still, I think when we got involved in the case, the family wasn't as publicly like out for answers as they are now and have been the past few years. So I think that led to some confusion on whether or not they were actually still looking for her. And I think that kind of fed into James Renner's theory of she ran away and she doesn't want to know her family anymore. But that really couldn't be further from the truth. They want answers. And unfortunately, I think Fred, his personality doesn't really gel too well with the New Hampshire State Police and the way they do things. And that's just like an immovable object meets an unstoppable force. I think
line.
it's just a clash that is, you know, really, because it's unfortunate, but it's just like almost like looking at it from a distance now. You know, I don't really know Fred personally, but I see that situation as something that seems like unavoidable. You know, there needs to be some other liaison there, and there has been. So like the Murray family, they have gotten better at communicating with the police because they know they have to work with them to find answers and bring closure.
And there is a lot of talk about Fred being you know, adversarial towards the police and the family not involved in it. But again, you got to kind of put yourself back into that time period, 2004, 2005, right up until 2008 or nine. Fred was very active in searching up there. There wasn't a lot of presence on social media about it. And once the social media started to become more of a tool to incorporate in the search, then the family became more present. It doesn't mean that they weren't present in the searches and the investigation prior, but no one knew because they just didn't have Facebook groups about it. So on the surface, it looks like, oh, well, all of a sudden the family's coming out of the woodwork, but it's really not the case at all. It's just, there's been a lot more, you know, Facebook groups, the TV show, our podcast, we're talking about it right now. So their involvement grew naturally with society, I guess you'd say.
Yeah, I would think that the medium, you know, the podcast medium definitely allows, you know, you guys keep the story open-ended and similar to what I, you know, kind of follow your formula in that regard with my podcast, because I do believe that both cases are solvable. Whether or not you ever get, it's just one of those enigmas, or a mystery wrapped in a enigma, whatever the hell the expression is, but you know what I mean. It's just, I mean, there's so many fucking unanswered questions.
Yeah.
Within the what happened, like, why didn't she get in the car with Butch, but she would have gotten in the car with the next guy?
I mean, yeah. that's a frustrating thing, is that yeah. all the unanswered questions, you just can't, you can't use, like, let that frustration force you into an answer that you're going to then be very protective of. So because there's no answer to something, like, say, the rag in the tailpipe, then you're like, you start making the answer for it. And then you start missing, like, the answer was there. You know, so everyone says the rag in the tailpipe, it's so mysterious, and I wonder if it was this killer that put it in there. But the answer's right there. Faith Westman says there's a flurry of activity by the trunk. Her dad told her at one point, put a rag in the tailpipe if you needed to get past like campus police and your car was sputtering and smoking so you didn't get pulled over. It was a temporary fix. And he even says like later on, you know, this isn't his words. I'm just paraphrasing. He basically said it was a dumb thing to tell her, but it was a temporary fix. So he had told her to do that. Faith Westman saw this. I mean, it all kind of comes together. So the answers are there. But because everything is so mysterious, people have to make up their, you know, it's so frustrating. So they just get locked in on it being what they want it to be in their head, their own narrative. And that's, you know, it doesn't do much progress, you know, for the progress of everything.
Yeah. You kind of like, if you want to create a theory, you kind of have to make decisions along the way. It's a little bit like a choose your own adventure. Like if you think one thing early in the story, then you must think something later because you have to, or else your own theory doesn't work. Right. But
that's good. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And you find that a lot with the cops, I mean, or with, you know, with cases that they end up being overturned or, you know, wrongful convictions or, you know, people confessing under duress, like you get that hindsight, you know, 2020. It's basically what it boils down to.
I actually have better than 2020 vision. I don't know if you
Tim actually does have better. It's 2015.
Yeah.
I have terrible vision.
Wait, 2015 is better than 2020?
Yeah. Because how does it go? What Tim can see. Tim can see at 20 feet what other people have to go 15 feet to see.
You son of a bitch.
Yeah, I know. Another reason to hate him.
You're like Daredevil.
Oh, you're right. It is 2015. Yeah. Vision is better than 2020. Okay, yeah. So that's what I have.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mine's 2040, to put it into perspective.
Oh, really? Wow.
2040. So what I see, what most people see at 20 feet. Wait, how does it go? What I see at 20 feet, most people can see at 40 feet.
Wow. So I'm three times cooler than you.
Just about. But that means that what I see at 20 feet, you could see at 25 feet.
Wow. But does that work the opposite way? Like,
oh,
like
the opposite, 55 feet.
But doesn't that work like, but if I gain something like vision, you gain something like style, whereas like to every three great jackets you have, I have one.
Oh, because your vision is three times greater than mine. So yeah, it's like the blind, like if I were to go totally blind, you're saying exactly, like my hearing would be like a dog.
Exactly. Yeah. You'd start hearing all those whistles, and you'd be like, "What the hell's going on?"
Yeah, this is gold, Bill. We're giving you gold.
No, this is radio gold. Trust me. I mean, let's reference Teen Wolf while we're at it. I mean, shit.
When?
Right now, because we're talking about dog whistles.
What a better segue. I'm more of a Teen Wolf 2 fan.
Oh, you like the Jason Bateman? Come on.
I like the damn.
I like the MTV show.
Oh, okay, good. Is that still on?
Guys, I'm a millennial too.
Oh, no, you're not.
An elder millennial.
No, I have no idea if that's still on. I didn't watch it.
I did. Yeah.
It's on in the background. Speaking of backgrounds, you have LeBron James's jersey in your background.
Yeah, that my dad passed away about 10 years ago. And that used to actually, he was a banker, president. You know, he was like the president of the bank, and he had season tickets, and I think that was one of the gifts they gave him. So that's his rookie signed jersey.
Oh, nice.
Sweet.
Wow. His first stint on the Cavs.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, that was a fun year. I got to, sit courtside like three times and,
nice.
Yeah. Working in the media wasn't too shabby. I made good friends with, Mike Snyder, who does like all the play by play stuff, or at least the halftime and pregame stuff for the Cavs. And
cool.
I was like, yeah, man, can I come down and check it out? And he's like, yeah, just pick up a pass and meet me at shoot around. And I literally just was like, it was like Wayne's World, you know, just walking around with my pass. Like, I got it. I'm cool. And they let me literally walk across the court like during shoot around. It was like, holy shit, this is really actually happening. Wow.
Oh wow. So did you cover sports or that was just like a one time thing?
That was a one time thing. I've always been more of a general assignment. I did investigative producing for a while for if you Google Carl Monday, you'll Daily Show did a good spoof on him. But yeah, he was Cleveland's classic stick your microphone in your face and be like, why are you sleeping in your truck? Or, you know, what are you taking the city dollars for? And shit, let me tell you, the conversations I had with the people that would call his office, whoa, buddy. Yeah, and he would look at me and be like, hey, if they're calling the news station, and it still goes today. I'm a producer at 5, which is the ABC affiliate here in Cleveland.
Oh, very cool.
But I only do that on the weekends, which allows me to do the podcasting as well, which is nice. And they don't restrict me on what I do, so that's all good too.
Gotcha.
But yeah, it's I don't know what I was going with that, but yeah, it's fucking Cleveland media and media in general. But
I heard Cleveland's got great restaurants.
We do actually have great restaurants. We're a very foodie city. We are, we have Michael Simon, Rocco Whalen. These are guys are places, they have places all over the country. So, they all got their start here, and there's like these little pockets of Cleveland that are really great for just like, just like the best food you'll ever have in your life. It's really, really good stuff. And Cleveland gets a bad rap, but at least 5 months of the year, it is a lot of fun.
Five months is long enough.
Yeah. Who says anything bad about Cleveland?
No, I don't know. Yeah, just about everybody, but
well, didn't the river catch on fire?
Oh yeah, see, exactly. There we go. You know.
is that like an old thing that people from Cleveland are like, river catching on fire.
Oh, it's just yeah, it's one of those it's exactly what it's like. It's like you think of New York City and you go, "Ah, the mafia runs the garbage," and you know, I'm not cut that out because they probably do, but anyway, like just saying, it was the mistake on the lake and all that stuff. We've come a long way, I'll just say that. And Cleveland is actually, if you get a chance to ever come, you know, you're here for whatever reason, definitely I could give you tons of recommendations as far as...
it looks like you have a nice little studio there in the background. Maybe we could come down and do a in-person show.
Yeah.
Truly be cozy.
Yeah, and Renner comes up from Akron. He's only like 30, 40 minutes from me. And then Nick from True Crime Garage. As I said, like we talk like every couple weeks. So, heck yeah. If you guys want to do it in person sometime, that'd be sweet. But yeah, I just kind of expanded the studio and put in the window and all that shit and had to fight my wife and all that. You know.
Very cool. Yeah.
Hopefully that didn't get you into too much trouble.
Yeah.
Well, it was just like, you'll get it when it's done. Like, just trust me. But when there's a big hole in the wall, it's a little hard to trust me. So,
yeah.
I don't know. I think
it looks beautiful. Looks top notch.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. You kind of fall into the gear rabbit hole and, I did that for a while. And then one day it was like, the wife looked at me and was like, you gotta stop buying shit and you gotta kind of start producing. I was
like, yeah, right.
Good point. Good point.
Yeah.
But yeah, I love like all this shit. I could do a whole episode on just gear that I've either gone through or, just in a year. I just enjoy that aspect of things. I don't know. I'm not an audio engineer by any stretch and couldn't tell you fucking anything about it, but I like to buy good shit.
Yeah, it seems like you've bought some good mics and stuff.
Yeah, well, you know, Google's an amazing thing.
Amazon's a dangerous thing.
Oh, don't even get me started on Amazon. Oh shit. Yeah, that, oh yeah, especially with like the next day delivery. Oh.
It's great.
Oh yeah, it's great. Yeah, not for your budget, but great.
Of course.
Yeah, but it's but yeah, and just let's just, and before we like, you know, go too far off base, but is there anything you wanted to say, like, as far as your feelings about where the case stands and what you hope you'll see in the future? Do you guys have any, like, you did the documentary, do you have anything else planned in that regard? I know you guys have, you know, plug the Crime Fest, plug all that stuff. I mean, so
yeah,
your final, yeah, what are your final thoughts on the Maura Murray case?
Well, I think what's happened, and aside from trying to find a solution, which is obviously, you know, the most asked question, which is, you know, what do you think happened, and where do you, you know, where would you like it to be in, you know, a certain period of time? That's a natural question to ask, but something that Tim and I have discovered over the past couple of years is that by talking about Maura's case, we've created a platform where we can talk about other cases and we can talk about other missing people, and we can simultaneously check in on Maura's case, and we'll always be getting tips. We'll always be in communication with the family and with law enforcement and with the community that looks into it and goes up there and they do their boots on the ground searches. And we're always in communication with these people. Anything new comes up, we'll talk about it. But we've done so many episodes on Maura and created this platform for other people who have missing loved ones that we can talk about and raise awareness for, like we're trying to do and like we did with Maura. And that's what part of the Crime Fest that we're organizing, co-organizing with PI Magazine and Unsolved Magazine, the publishers of those magazines. We're co-organizing this, and it's all about awareness. It's all about being an advocate. It's all about doing the right thing with the platform that you've created. And I think that's something that's just, it continually becomes more and more apparent to us. That's as mature as I get.
Yeah, that's well said. No joke needed on my end.
Give us a joke.
Horse walks into a bar. Bartender says, "Why the long face?"
The horse says, "Why am I in Cleveland?"
It's what's brown and green and has four legs and will kill you if it falls out of a tree? A pool table.
Nice. Good
Yeah, you know, and I, and in all reality, I mean, I do believe that that is exactly what you guys did create. You've created a template for me to follow. I know that my platform, you know, Who Killed Amy Mahalovic, because we've ventured into, you know, I'm a one-man band, but, you know, I've ventured into other cases, and I just did a 5-part series on the Colonial Parkway murders with Bill Thomas. Nick from True Crime Garage was a member of the last two episodes, or a guest on the last two episodes, I should say. And yeah, I do. I think that this is a great, great medium for advocacy and for telling stories that otherwise just kind of get brushed aside. Otherwise, it's just being a news producer and having a hand on what is written, it's difficult to write and get across a story in even in a 2-minute package, but let alone in a voiceover, a 20-second spot.
Yeah, completely.
Yeah, it's impressive to take something on like that, like the Amy Mahalovic case, and work with such personalities, good personalities. You know, you're working with James Renner, and you're working with Nick, and you're all working together. So that's great, you know, because not a lot of people can do that. A lot of people let egos get in their way. I do. That's why you can't see me on this video, because it can't contain my ego in the frame.
Yeah, he would actually charge you. He would invoice you. He would actually invoice me, which is pretty weird, but he does. Yeah.
I just invoiced both of you right now.
So I'm getting charged an appearance fee. You're going to get oh, damn it.
Yep.
I thought we passed that through I thought we passed it through your agent before. Come on.
Yeah. I'm my own agent.
You call the shots as the shots come, right?
Yes. It's a privilege fee.
I like it. So anyway, that's good shit. Thanks so much. Thank you so much. And now we're just gonna do a like a formal end. But I do appreciate the time, guys. Anybody who isn't familiar with the case, what's the name of your podcast again?
Missing Maura Murray and Crawl Space. We also do one about art crime called Empty Frames.
All right. And if they did want to get a hold of you on social, you guys have a Twitter account or anything along those lines?
Yeah, might as well follow the main account. If you can only follow one, follow us at Crawl Space Pod.
All right, right on. Well, again, I really do appreciate the time. I know that both your guys' schedules are absolutely insane, and I can't thank you enough. So thank you very much for joining me today.
No, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
All right. I hope you guys enjoyed that episode with Tim and Lance. That was a throwback due to some minor health issues that impacted my work week. So I apologize. I will have a new episode next week. And again, Tim and Lance are great. Check out their podcasts, Crawl Space, Missing Maura Murray, all the Crawl Space media stuff they do. They're really a force in the industry. So as you guys know, I drop new episodes every Friday. And this year I will be back at CrimeCon in Las Vegas for 2022. And that's April 29th through May 1st. And that's a bucket list item for any true crime fan. So if you want to save money on your ticket, you can use my promo code WHOKILLED. If you do enjoy this podcast or any of the other shows that I produce, you can help support them by clicking on the donate button on slowburnmedia.com. And that's slow minus the W. Or if you want to contribute directly, you can use the Venmo app with my username at bill-huffman-3. I will also provide a link in the show notes. Now, every contribution does help keep these slow burn podcasts on the air. You can help leave a 5-star review. That keeps the cases that I cover in the spotlight. So, again, if you'd like to stay up to date on the shows that I've done, the cases that I've covered, or whatever's in the pipeline, follow me on Twitter at BillHuffman3. Thank you guys so much again for listening this week. Until next time, stay healthy and be safe.
On the morning of August 1st, 1966, shots ring out from the observation deck of the clock tower on the University of Texas campus. It marks the infamous beginning of the modern era of mass shootings in America.
You're listening to Stop the Killing podcast. Join us as we take you behind the crime scene tape to explain global mass shootings and mass attacks. I'm Sarah Ferris, but more importantly, this is Catherine Schweit, the former head of the FBI's active shooter program.
I spent 5 years as the FBI's top executive looking for answers to the mass shooting crisis. I've been at the shooting scenes. I've traced heroic acts of bravery. And I've sat silently and listened to the heart-wrenching stories from survivors.
Amongst this horror, there is hope. We all hold the key to stop the killing. You just need to know how to unlock the door. Download Stop the Killing and be part of the solution. Search Stop the Killing on Apple, Spotify, and all the usual suspects.
You might be surprised to know that not all serial killers are straight, cisgender white men. And the victims of true crime are not a monolith either. She's Wendy and I'm Beth, and together we host Fruit Loop's Serial Killers of Color, a true crime podcast.
Together, we take deep dives into the true crime stories about marginalized and minoritized perps and victims that often go untold.
We also provide the context and nuance that these stories deserve. At Fruit Loops, we're serving up true crime with a side of history, society, culture, and some fun.
Listen to Fruit Loops Serial Killers of Color on Spotify, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.